Yeah, I forgot the terminology that we used for it, because it's been some time since I looked at this. I know it's under the required theft. I mean, the required labor. Theft falls under required labor, the protocol, that's the word I was thinking about. There's a protocol for each category for sentences, and the judge has referred to the sentencing protocol for that category.
Okay, so...
Protocol is in where?
Is it in the bill?
Senator Butt, if I may, this is kind of a shorthand version of the rules. The rules themselves spell out what the presumptive sentence would be.
No, just put the front page. It's not the one with the box. It's now it says Division 25.
That's correct.
Wait, no, it still has a box. It has a long skinny box.
A long skinny box at the top, Division 25.
We don't have a long skinny box.
I don't have it.
Those of us up here don't have a long skinny box.
Looks like this.
This is wrong. It is the one that says, it is, say, Division 25, Statement of Principles.
That's correct.
Don't confuse me with boxes.
Okay, well...
Pieces of paper have varied templates around here.
Maybe if I read through all this, I wouldn't need to ask the question, but since you're here, what I'm trying to figure out, there will be a system when we're done so that a judge can look at the crime category and say a theft 2 fits with this presumptive sentence.
Right. Okay. And all I was trying to indicate is I think this was prepared for your benefit rather than a trial court judge's benefit.
Okay.
Ours would be somewhat more detailed than this.
Okay, but assuming then that yours leads you back to a shorthand version, which is something like this.
What page is that?
If you look at theft 2, now the top part of this misdemeanor sentencing guideline says every category allows for jail. And yet when I look at theft 2, the first is restitution. So where does jail fall in, and then do you have a departure under misdemeanor sentencing guidelines?
Senator Bunn, in response to that, I believe Judge Leonard was prepared to walk you through the operation of the rules, and maybe this is the time to do that. I think that'll answer your question.
Okay.
In general, we tried to stay away from departure-type terminology because of the baggage that carries with it from sentencing guidelines. But I'll let Judge Leonard address that in more detail.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm going to skip back to my jury if I could, Madam Chairman.
We'll call you again when we need you, and that might be sooner rather than later, but thanks. We appreciate your time.
Good afternoon. My name is Kip Leonard, and I'm a circuit judge in Lane County, and I also have been involved with the misdemeanor guidelines project since its beginning, and before that I was involved with the council as an associate member during the process when felony guidelines were promulgated. Just as a little bit of background, I think I shared Paul's skepticism about misdemeanor guidelines, and in fact I think I was the one that suggested Paul be placed on the committee just so we have a little balance, had a balance of opinion or perhaps a little reinforcement. And I, too, as we went through the project, I, too, came to the conclusion that what we came up with was a very valuable product that I think deserves the consideration of the legislature. And what I'd like to do is walk you through the rules that you have in front of you. That is the document, I believe, that's entitled Statement of Purposes and Principles. And if you have the same one I do, and I hope you do, because I will be referring to page numbers, I'll begin. What I would like to do is do it in narrative form as opposed to page by page, because I think narrative form will give you a little bit better idea of how the misdemeanor guidelines work. And maybe by one more bit of preface, that would be that in thinking about misdemeanor guidelines, I'd like for all of you to forget everything you know about felony guidelines for the moment, because they aren't similar. And one of the reasons we did give you this sheet of paper, this long sheet of paper that says misdemeanor sentencing guidelines, is to give you an idea that at least schematically, misdemeanor guidelines bear no resemblance to felony guidelines. There is not a grid. This would be the schematic of misdemeanor guidelines. A person convicted of a misdemeanor and then to be sentenced by a district or circuit judge would find himself or herself being sentenced based upon the facts of the particular crime. The facts of the crime will determine where that individual is placed in what we have come up with as six categories, six sanction-appropriate categories. And those are the categories listed on this sheet: incarceration, required labor, compliance, community restitution, behavioral control, and driving under the influence of intoxicants. For about 50 misdemeanors that David referred to, those have already been categorized and placed in particular categories. Those comprise about 85, maybe 90% of the misdemeanors that are prosecuted on an annual basis, at least according to the figures that we were able to develop. Those have been placed into particular categories. Crimes that aren't categorized, that are non-listed, would be categorized based upon the facts of the particular offense, not based upon the name of the crime. So a judge sentencing an individual would take a look at what an individual is accused of doing, what the individual has been convicted of in beginning the sentence process. For individuals who are convicted of listed misdemeanors, that those listed misdemeanors, based upon their facts, don't necessarily fit within the category that they have been placed in by the rules, the judge is free to move that individual and move that crime from one category to another based upon the facts of the crime. Each category, and again we're talking about categories, these are the six categories on this sheet, each category has what we call a sentencing protocol. And if you look at the rules on page 2, sentencing protocol is defined as the narrative description of each classification criteria, sentencing considerations, and the presumptive sentence for each sanction appropriate misdemeanor category.
Here, it's page 2. It's actually page 3.
We may have different copies here. Mine's numbered page 2 at the bottom. Are we on the same?
3.
Okay.
Under definitions.
Under definitions.
Okay.
It's rule 25-26-001 sub 8. The sentencing protocols, which are listed in detail in the appendices at the... Oh, okay. I have a copy of the document you have, so I will refer to that. Thank you. The sentencing protocols are listed in the appendices at the back of this document. And to give you an example of what the protocols look like, I would ask that you turn to page 22, and that is the sentencing protocol for incarcerative misdemeanors. Those are misdemeanors that it has felt that are most appropriately dealt with a jail sentence, along with perhaps other components, such as restitution, supervision term, perhaps a treatment program, those are listed in the sentencing considerations and the presumptive sentence category. Those are what?
Excuse me. Yes, Senator Bunn.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but on the sanction units, I've heard a discussion before, but I don't recall. How is 1 day a sanction unit for?
1 day of jail is a sanction unit. And that information, Senator Bunn, is more particularly set out in on page 10, which is rule 253-29-030.
Thank you.
And that also includes other situations, such as residential treatment. There is a formula for community service work. The sentencing protocols are those things that it is felt that has been determined should be the focus of a sentence that falls typically within the category, the sanction-appropriate category, that the crime has been placed in. And in arriving at these, we talked about what we thought were typical cases. And clearly not all cases are typical, and we'll talk about how the guidelines provide for that in just a moment. But somebody whose crime of conviction falls within the range of being a typical conviction for that sort of offense should be sentenced based upon the protocols listed for that particular category. For example, we have felt that assaultive crimes deserve and are appropriate for a jail sanction. And that is provided for in the sentence in the sentencing protocol for incarcerative misdemeanors, and that includes assaults. We also feel or felt that there are other components of a sentence that are appropriate, such as restitution, if that is needed in an assaultive crime, perhaps treatment if the individual has an underlying problem with perhaps drugs or alcohol or anger control management. And we contemplate that a sentence in the incarcerative category, as with probably most all of the sentences that are imposed in misdemeanor for misdemeanors, would include some period of probation so that the components of the sentence can be supervised and enforced. If a judge finds that an individual is not appropriate for sentencing in the protocol that is listed, the sentencing judge has the ability to impose a non-presumptive sentence. And that is provided for by rule, and that is on page, get the page right in your, it's provided on page 6. A non-presumptive sentence is a sentence that may be imposed by the court for the reasons but not limited to the fact that any one or more of the elements of the presumptive sentence constitute an inappropriate sanction, or the correctional or treatment resources needed to execute the sentencing requirements are unavailable. If the judge finds that and states it on the record, then a non-presumptive sentence may be imposed. If a non-presumptive sentence is imposed, then the judge is free to sentence within the boundaries of what is allowable as a sentence has been, or what is allowable by sentence under ORS for that particular crime. For example, if it's Class A misdemeanor, the maximum penalty is a year in jail and a fine of $2,500, subject to the 6-month jail cap that was imposed as part of the felony guidelines. If a judge sentences imposes a presumptive sentence, there are limitations on the number of jail units or sanction units that can be imposed as part of the upfront sentence, as part of probation, as a condition of probation. And for each offense, the rules have provided for the listed misdemeanors, a maximum number of sanction units that can be imposed as a condition of probation. And for unlisted misdemeanors, the limitations are 60 sanction units for a Class A misdemeanor, 30 for a Class B, and 15 for a Class C misdemeanor. It's contemplated that probation is going to be imposed in most cases, as it is now in sentencing misdemeanors. The rules have included in the rules a number of statements concerning probation, because it was felt by the committee that probation should not be used as punishment in and of itself. That probation should be used for the purpose of seeing to it that the conditions of probation are met, and that excessively long periods of probation, unless there is a reason for it, should not be imposed, and that probation, once the terms of probation are being met, that judges should be encouraged to terminate probation. And that's provided for by rule on, I believe, page 8 of your document. I think I'm one page off. It's contemplated that most probations in the misdemeanor arena will be bench probations, or that supervised by the court. There are few, I guess it varies county to county, but generally in the state, there's not great use made of supervised probation. Some counties have more facilities and resources than others. I think given the budget limitations that are going to be faced in the foreseeable future, that we can expect that fewer cases will be supervised in the misdemeanor area. There are some that are particularly appropriate for supervised probation, and clearly the rules provide that supervised probation is an option. Sex crimes come to mind as being misdemeanors that are often subject to supervised probation.
Could I go back just a moment to the not the probationary sentence, but the incarceration sentence.
In the incarcerative?
I guess I'm on page 6.
Okay.
The presumptive, non-presumptive kind of absorbed this. Says the presumptive sentence shall be imposed in every case, except as provided in subsection 2, which provides that you refer to a statutorily mandated sentence when that is available. Then there are non-presumptive sentences which talk about an alternative sentence. Does that mean that if the judge wants to impose a greater or a lesser sanction units, that are all impositions of greater or lesser sanction units included within a non-presumptive sentence, right?
No. No, the sanction units that are imposed, is actually imposed as a condition of probation, let's say. For instance, a judge wants to give somebody 10 sanction units. They are able to do that if they're going to exceed the number of sanction units available for that particular offense as an upfront sentence. That would then have to be a non-presumptive sentence.
Okay.
Perhaps what I'm about to talk to you next may get right back into what your question pertained to, and that is that jail or sanction units as a sentence and or a condition of probation have initial limitations if a presumptive sentence is imposed. And the limitation is the 60 sanction units or the 30 sanction units or the 15 sanction units or whatever it may be provided by the rules. So if somebody is going to be given a presumptive sentence, then the maximum number of sanction units that may be imposed as a condition of probation are limited by the sanction units provided for by rule. And those are limitations that I think provide some proportionality with the felony guidelines. If it is a non-presumptive sentence, the judge is not limited by the number of sanction units that are provided for by rule. The judge is limited only by statute. And again, that's a year, 6 months, or 30 days, depending on whether it's A, B, or C misdemeanor. If an individual is placed on probation and the number of sanction units that are provided for by rule are automatically reserved, if you're familiar with felony guidelines, there has been some controversy and some difference of opinion as to whether a judge at the time of sentencing has to make a statement and say, I am imposing X number of custody units in order to have those available if the individual comes back and to be punished for a probation violation. It's done by operation of law under the misdemeanor guidelines, and the judge has those available sanction units up to 60, 45, 30, whatever it may be, to punish probation violations. If a judge uses all of those sanction units and wants to incarcerate the person further, the only thing a judge could do is revoke probation. If a judge revokes probation, the judge then has the authority and the ability to go beyond and sentence the person up to the maximum allowable sentence provided for by statute, giving the individual credit for time served. But that would only be for a probation violation. One of the features of misdemeanor guidelines that is takes a page from the felony guidelines book and adds to it and incorporates it, I think, with a little bit more utility, is that the supervision of sanction units can be delegated to a supervisory authority, such as a probation officer. And that probation officer will have the authority to use up to one half of the available reserved sanction units to enforce and punish violations of the individuals of the defendant's probation. For example, if an individual is on probation for assault in the fourth degree and there are 50 available sanction units left, the supervisory authority would have 12 and a half custody units. 25 custody units. Did you have a question?
I'd like to back up to something. Okay. You were talking about probation, and if you revoke their probation, you can give them up to the full time allowed by statute minus time served. Last session, we dealt with a bill that would give an ability or take away an ability to reject probation and just take your sentence. If we have, in essence, said you can't opt out of probation, all someone has to do is violate their probation to opt out of it, isn't it?
They could.
Okay, so from the way you described it, if somebody says,
They wouldn't, if I can explain, if they violated their probation to try to opt out of it, the judge still has the ability either to continue the individual on probation or to revoke their probation and to sentence them.
Okay, but at any point the individual is sentenced, it can never exceed the statutory authorization minus time served, can it?
No, it can't.
So an individual could just be extremely obnoxious and say the probation is useless. Well, I guess I'll deal with this another time. I'm just not sure I understand how it works to tell somebody you can't opt out when they're intent on doing so.
Well, I mean, it probably would be a useless act on the part of the judge to try to continue somebody on probation if they demonstrated an extreme unwillingness to participate in probation. And if that's the case, then I would think, as a sentencing judge, what I probably would do is would say, okay, probation's not working. I'm revoking probation, and I'm going to sentence you. And I would have available to me under misdemeanor guidelines what I have available to me now as a sentencing judge, and that is to sentence somebody up to the maximum that's provided for by law. And that, for a Class A misdemeanor, is a year in jail, and for a Class B, it's 6 months, and for a Class C, it's 30 days. So this scheme doesn't really change that, Senator. All it does is it changes the way that probation works and how probation is supervised and what can be done to punish probation violations. But once probation is revoked, then a judge has the authority that he or she has always had under the law to sentence that individual.
Okay, now, if you punish a probation violation, so you're using part of those sanction units to mm-hmm. punish that, you still have the option at some point of revoking, and again, that punishment is time served that you subtract. What happens if you have punishment units that are not incarceration? Are you still allowed the full 1 year minus incarceration, so that you've had the 1 year incarceration plus some other type of units, community service, for example?
As a probation, if you're going to revoke somebody's probation?
Well, first, if you punish them for violating probation, do you have a circumstance where someone is on probation, you punish them for violating that, but you haven't revoked it yet,
mm-hmm.
and then at some point subsequent to that, you revoke it?
That happens frequently.
Okay, so if you revoke it and you subtract time served, what happens with community service or something else, which is a unit that is served?
If community service was imposed as a sanction unit, then the individual will be given credit for that time served. If community service was not imposed as a sanction unit, but merely as a condition of probation, then the individual would not be given credit for it, as the law is now. Okay. The law under this misdemeanor guideline proposal does not change the sentencing practice or sentencing laws that we have now, and that is that if an individual is revoked and placed in jail for a period of time, the individual is going to be given credit for the time that they have served. You can't give somebody probation and, as a condition of probation, give them 30 days in jail, have them serve it, have them then violate their probation, bring them in, revoke them, give them a year in jail, and not give them credit for the 30 days. That, if you did that, then the individual would have ended up serving a year and 30 days.
Thank you.
Okay. What I was starting to talk about was the ability for a supervisory authority to supervise an individual's probation and to enforce that probation through the use by the supervisory authority of sanction units. For instance, if a supervisory authority, under the example I was giving, had 25 sanction units, available for their use, and an individual who is on probation failed the drug test. The probation officer, or whoever the supervisory authority may be, would have the ability, the authority, to place somebody in jail for a period of time or into some other program up to the 25 sanction units that they have, with the provision that the individual has the right to have a hearing on the matter, and all of the due process rights are guaranteed. But this would be a departure from what the practice is now, although it is provided for in felony guidelines, and it would be of assistance to the trial courts in that it would take the supervision, the day-to-day supervision of a lot of the small problems in probation supervision away from the courts and give them to the supervisory authority, if there is one. And that supervisory authority is probably in a situation better to supervise the individual and control their behavior on a more immediate basis than the courts are, given that the process to get somebody back into court is cumbersome, expensive, and not particularly effective. If somebody violates their probation, what is typically done is that that information is given to the district attorney's office. The district attorney's office reviews it, decides whether to file a probation violation order to show cause against the individual. If they do, it is filed, a warrant is issued, the sheriff arrests them, they're taken into custody, they are arraigned, they may well be appointed an attorney, a hearing may well be set, the person may well be continued in custody, the hearing occurs, and the individual then is sentenced, all of which is rather relatively cumbersome. This process would allow for direct supervision by supervisory authority. It's analogous to a couple of programs that are going on right now on an experimental basis. I don't know if all of you are familiar with the DROP program that's being used in Coos County and I think Yamhill County and maybe some other counties where the exact same thing is being done. The probation officers are taking individuals that flunk drug tests and immediately sanctioning them, giving them the right to have a hearing if they wish, but immediately sanctioning them either upon admission or following a hearing, and it's proved to be a very successful program. From what I am able to gather from judges that have worked in that system, they think it's a much preferable way to supervising probationers for some violations of their probation than the system where an individual has to come back to court. So this system provides for it. It certainly would be limited by the availability of supervisory authorities in particular counties. Non-presumptive sentences that are imposed by a judge may be tailored by a judge to the particular facts of a crime, and the judge has available any sentencing option that a judge has now available to sentence an individual. The statutorily mandated sentences, sentences that provide for particular numbers of days in jail or particular fines, are kept as they are. The DUII incarcerative category includes that sort of provision because somebody convicted of DUII in the first instance is either to serve 2 days in jail or perform 80 hours of community service work in a minimum. Misdemeanor guidelines do nothing to impact statutorily mandated sentences. Plea agreements are unchanged. Both the district attorney and defense attorneys will have the same ability to plea bargain under misdemeanor guidelines as they are presently. The only provision is that if a sentence falls within the presumptive range, then a court would need to recognize the presumptive range unless the parties agree that it would be a non-presumptive sentence. An individual's prior record is not dealt with in misdemeanor guidelines as it is in felony guidelines. As you're aware, in felony guidelines, a criminal history is developed for each defendant, and that then scores the individual, and that criminal history becomes a factor in the grid. In misdemeanor guidelines, criminal history is an element that goes into deciding what the sentence is under the presumptive sentence, or it can be a factor for a judge to use in deciding that a non-presumptive sentence be imposed. Reasons for a non-presumptive sentence are to be set out in the record, but we do not contemplate that this has to be in writing. Merely needs to be stated and then needs to be noted on the sentencing, on the judgment form. As I mentioned before, misdemeanor sentencing guidelines encourage limited lengths of probation, except where they are needed to enforce to monitor the terms of the probation. And these rules do not apply to situations where a person may be found guilty except for insanity.
Now, if I understood correctly, the criminal history does not apply to choosing which category they're placed in, but it would determine how many sanction units might be given up to the limit in that category.
It would be a factor to be used by the judge in determining whether what sort of sentence may be imposed within the presumptive sentence range, or it may be a factor that the judge would use to decide that a non-presumptive sentence is to be used as opposed to the presumptive sentence.
Okay, but if a judge is to use the presumptive sentence, then mm-hmm. someone that has 10 convictions for theft two